Our second speaker is Gary Vitale. Gary is a professor of surgery at the University of Louisville. The taking care of the management and taking care of patients with bile duct injuries is clearly a team sport. And we rely and depend on our colleagues in interventional endoscopy and our interventional radiologists, as well as our diagnostic work that they provide. Gary is, in my opinion, one of the best surgical endoscopists in the world. He runs a great training program for surgical endoscopy, including ERCP, and has a busy general surgery practice as well, for which he manages all kinds of complex hepatopancreatic biliary disease. So it's a real pleasure and honor to have Gary Vitale here to describe the role of the endoscopist in the management of bile duct injuries. Gary.
Thank you very much, Keith. And I do surgical reconstruction as well as endoscopic management, so I just wanted to say that at the outset because I think it's important to have no bias and do what's best for the patient. My disclosures are I am a speaker for AbbVie regarding pancreas enzyme therapy, unrelated to current topic. I start just with one quick presentation of a patient, an older man, just to comment on the ERCP that you really don't want. White count after, he comes in with a sick gallbladder, CT shows cholecystitis, has a bile leak post-op. There's clips and dilated ducts. You know where this is going. This is the ERCP you really don't want your endoscopist to call you about, which is contrast goes up to the clips and stops dead. MPTC shows complete obstruction. That patient, of course, needs to undergo an operative repair. There's loss of tissue or at least complete occlusion and needs a hepatic jejunostomy. I just want to say this right up front, that surgeons need to be involved in the decision making for this if you're a GI person, especially if you've got a complex stricture and one that you're managing beyond a simple stent for a few months. So these things we don't need to discuss. The key factor here is on the title of this slide, high index of suspicion post-op. If your patient's got a little nausea and not doing well, just don't accept the fact that the patient's fine and send him home from the ER when he comes back. Do a few studies. Obviously, it's already been talked about. Intraop, don't accept that the IOC doesn't fill above. And then the number thing, post-op diagnosis, often subtle, vague abdominal pain, nausea. Even for a week to 10 days, it's surprising the number of patients who can come back with a belly full of bile. Now, some get sick right away, of course. Delay in diagnosis results in the complications that tend to lead more to complex reconstruction and to lawsuits because they're sent home from an ER twice by an ER doctor who never calls you. But if you're called, take it seriously for a post-op gallbladder patient. But peritonitis, sepsis, cholangitis, fistula, jaundice. The types of injuries, the simplest ones are, of course, the simple leaks, although those can get into some complex scenarios. The leak from the bile duct itself, which has a problem of causing a stricture as it heals long-term. Strictures due to cauterization clips, an inflammatory process that will resolve, of course. And then common bile duct transections and incisions. IOC, I don't really think we need to emphasize this at all in a talk to a group like this, but you know, it reduces the rate of necessary pre-op investigations such as ERCP, so I don't push my patients with mild gallstone pancreatitis to have ERCPs. I push my surgeons to do cholecystectomy and IOC. So when things are not clear to you, I would do a selective IOC because it may avoid that post-op ERCP, which has a risk of pancreatitis. And if you've got a problem going on, routine IOC, I think, is a good way to be adding things. Endoscopic interventions, which I'm going to talk about a little bit here. And the main reason for talking about this with a surgical group is to say that when it's done well, it is a reasonable alternative to surgery because there are many hepatobiliary surgeons, some of my best friends, who think that this is all trash and really everybody who has a significant stricture should be operated on. And, you know, there's some truth in that from the point of view if it's not managed properly. So the goal of endoscopic intervention is to reestablish biliary drainage, restore liver function, correct the defects, normalize the anatomy. And then, of course, there is the other side where you're doing some palliative interventions to prepare for operation even when you know operation is necessary. So the feasibility of ERCP, is there a previous upper GI operation that may push you move to go to a surgical approach, the characteristics of the injury, the time from injury, continuity of the bile duct, the leak condition, is it a generalized leak that needs a washout anyway, localization of the repair and previous operative repair. When endoscopic intervention is not indicated is when there's complete obstruction, you're unable to pass a guide wire, segmental loss of the bile duct, worsening peritonitis, or prior gastric surgery, although this is, that last one is not absolute. Now, one thing I'll talk about in this slide is segmental loss of the bile duct, because you'll see one slide where the radiologists are able to stick a wire and get across and then put a catheter through, and the question becomes, should you allow that to recanalize in some fashion? I think that's, and there are people out there with short segments that are being bridged. I'm not a fan of that. And then the other issue for the endoscopist, for me to read this slide now and then, and for your gastroenterologist, how much is too much with stenting? I mean, when do we stop? 12 to 16 months with a stent in place, that's really pretty reasonable. It allows a remolding of the mucosa, et cetera. I think it tends to work. That number seems to work. But you've got patients coming back with stents in for 3 or 4 years. How much is too much? How many stents? That's always been questionable. 2 or 3 is what I do when we can stretch them up. Costamagna, who has some of the best results in the world, has put up to 5 or 6 and just really jams them in there. I can't imagine it, but he does it. And I know him personally, and he's one of the best endoscopists in the world. But a more aggressive approach with stenting, that is, number of stents, seems to lead to a better result. What is your follow-up? Well, there is routine stent changes with dilatation during the time of stenting every 3 to 4 months, and after stent removal, lifetime annual liver function surveillance. And I was criticized at one meeting, I think it was the Central, saying, well, you're stenting all these people out after stenting and pulling their stents, and they're going to get recurrent strictures. You'll see later the data doesn't support that. But my answer to that is, that's the same problem we have with hepaticojejunostomy, dating back to Henry Pitt's article in the early 1980s, that a small number of patients will develop recurrent stricture of anastomoses or dilated strictures, 10, 15, up to 30 years out, although it's a very small number. So all patients with biliary reconstruction should be followed for a lifetime. Ductal Lushka leaks, I'm not going to talk about it. Anatomic incidence, 20% to 50%. So leaks, Strasburg reviewed a study in 1995, which is landmark because there's 270 injuries with 15% as Lushka leaks. There's a little duct of Lushka leak where that arrow is. Cystic duct leaks, you're all well aware of, and they are generally really well treated. The only thing I'll comment about this, I'm seeing a lot of endoscopists put in the big metallic stents. I think I have to seal this off, and a big job for it. But that leads to a small but real incidence of severe pancreatitis in some patients. And I've stopped using metallic stents in the normal ampulla for those reasons, and I reserve it for cancer patients. So again, cystic duct leak, place a stent, it goes away. Europeans use a lot of nasobiliary drains because then they don't have to do a sphincterotomy and they just pull it and avoids a second ERCP. I don't recommend that. This study talks about the grading system as low versus high and low grade leaks, which sort of leak after opacification of the intrahepatic radicals, and high grades leak before the radicals are opacified. One can be treated with stenting, and the others can get a sphincterotomy alone. Again, I've stented them all. It does require repeat ERCP, but there's data out there that's saying we could do less, and maybe over time we will. Again, a nasobiliary drain reduces your ERCPs down to 1. And the sphincterotomy alone is fine, but it's less effective, and the patient that you don't get an adequate closure, it sort of develops a chronic problem, so I like the stent with plastic stents. So then this gets back into, do you have to do a sphincterotomy at all? These are I'll move through this because these are sort of endoscopic questions. Some people think you don't, just put the stent, but there's a little higher incidence of pancreatitis, and there's definitely a higher incidence of pancreatitis with metallic stents, but we do use those in the very high volume, larger leaks. Distal obstruction from a stone, that's kind of obvious, and you have to remove the stone. There's a leak from a cystic duct, and there's a little, you probably can't see it on the slide, but there's a hypodense area with a stone there. Use of PTC, well, I think it's very important, obviously, with the major injuries with leaks. And it's when I'm dealing with leaks that are coming from other injuries other than iatrogenic, PTC can be very helpful because we can't get the ERCP done. And then between ERCP and PTC, you're going to end up finding the bile ducts that have tissue destruction. So ERCP and PTC are very important in your planning for surgery. And it's very important to identify right away which injuries are not amenable to endoscopic repair and get them onto a surgical treatment. Look at the number of clips up there in the top right of that slide. Pretty impressive. Here was an injection by PTC, but that looks great. You can just sew to that. But intraoperative, the purpose of this is intraoperative cholangiography, very important, or doing an MRI and a PTC to make sure you have. Because while this might have been the whole bile duct, it wasn't. There's the other side of the bile duct, and this patient required two anastomoses. So again, PTC can be very, very helpful in these cases. This is one of those cases where there was a bile leak, and you say there's nothing else can be done. Well, it turned out to be very narrow, and they were able to bridge it. Again, I'm not a fan, unless there's absolutely no loss of tissue, and trying this as a definitive repair, but you have to. I think this is definitely the case where the managing doctor, if he's a GI person, which is very often the case these days, consult with they can go to the hospitalist for 2 or 3 days before they decide to call us. It's just crazy what goes on these days in referring. But if there's a loss of tissue, even if they can bridge it, I think this is a good case for hepaticojejun ostomy. Looking at 86 benign strictures that we had, this included our iatrogenic pancreatitis and trauma. Over a 5-year period, we had 86 benign strictures. The purpose of this is to show what happens to benign strictures when they're stented. So we managed about 80% endoscopically, and the clinical symptoms resolved with small related procedural complications and no mortality. Basically, this fits with other people who are doing similar work for benign strictures. But the results are what's important, longer term and the follow-up. At that point, that group, I'll show you a later follow-up here of 5 years, but at that point with this larger group, recurrent strictures of 3%. Costamagna, again, has superb results with no recurrence. But I'd say the average is probably going to be 5 to 15% of recurrence over follow-ups of 5 years, which I think is similar, actually, to hepaticojejun ostomy. Iatrogenic common hepatic duct strictures, there was what it looked like to begin with. At the bottom right is one that it looked like 4 years later. You'd say that looks irregular, probably should have hepaticojejun ostomy, but it works. We follow them up, and the recurrence rate is very, very low, less than 5%, which can be treated by by percutaneous or endoscopic dilatation at a later date. So the treatment is progressive dilatation and stenting. It resolves the stricture in 80% of patients when you have a 4-year follow-up. These strictures require you pass a guide wire through the stricture first, do a balloon dilatation, pass the plastic stent, then do multiple stents. This was a series that we pulled out for the central surgical presentation, I think. It was 30 just major bile duct injury. We got rid of all the other extraneous stuff, but major bile duct injuries from cholecystectomy. We averaged 12 months for stenting, although some went longer. 10 patients required repeat stenting, and 8 were treated successfully. 2 required conversion due to a treatment failure, and the follow-up was about 5 years. This fits well with other studies we're seeing. This was Costamagna's study with 45 patients, success rate, and he followed this up and continues to have good results. Success rate about 90%, you could get it done, 42% completed the protocol, and at 48 months he had no recurrence. I think that's unusual. There will probably be always some recurrence. A retrospective study which makes the complications and mortality rate hard to read, but that's not why I put this slide up. So 157 patients, surgery versus endoscopy for post-cholecystectomy bile duct strictures. But the recurrent stenosis rate, which is interesting to me, 6% in the endo group, 5% in the surgical group, very similar, even in a study that you have different etiologies and it's retrospective. I think that follow-up post-treatment is useful. So use of stenting represents an acceptable choice for benign biliary strictures when it's used selectively in a team approach, and long-term data suggest a low but persistent recurrence rate of strictures with either endoscopic or surgical treatment necessitating careful follow-up. And those last two words, I think, are the most important part of the talk to me, is you have to have careful follow-up. In our state, every patient with a biliary problem, particularly if I had my finger on that patient at any point, if they have a problem, they get sent back to me. Matter of fact, I think my number is written on the bathroom wall of every ER in the state at this point, for complex patients with chronic pain and any kind of biliary or pancreatitis problem. So I do see my patients back, but in a lot of practice patterns, you don't. You operate on them and they go away. And I do think some patients will come back with biliary cirrhosis if they have chronic partial obstruction long time from either endoscopic stenting that is a chronic failure or a chronic stricture from hepaticojejunostomy. So that's very important for all of us. Well, thank you very much for letting me add that endoscopic side into the discussion today.